welcome, my folk and good friends. Very nice of you to stop by. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and we are always glad that you want to spend some of your time with us. We try to make it worth your time, of course, by bringing interesting thoughts and propositions to the table by speaking with researchers, authors, bloggers, thinkers, and doers on the program to give you a different view, something you will never hear on the mainstream media channels, and not most alternative channels either. The topic today is going to be on language. What we'll be getting into today is about the symbolic nature of language and how different languages found in different parts of the world have shaped our minds and make up how we view the world differently depending on what language we speak and how it has shaped our thinking, our minds, and ultimately our brains. So the destruction of language, both by newspeak and self-censorship and the PC police, is of course a very worrying element. But it's worse than that. Over time, our languages have been altered and in some cases intentionally destroyed. A natural transformation probably occurs at some point, yes, but there's been efforts of centralization within our nations that have ultimately given us a more narrow view of the world, especially since the Second World War, when education and schooling started to destroy the various diverse dialects. Take an example, Gutish, or the Gothic language of southern Sweden, had at one time around 120 different distinct dialects that by some language scholars in the area said were actually like different languages. And that's only in one country alone. This didn't make people unable to understand each other. These languages were related, but the point here is that they were very distinct and they had some words quite unique to the area they were in that was actually based on the environment around them. So this is an important story to realize that the loss of language means a loss of a way of looking at the world, especially at this time as Mandarin, English, Spanish, and Hindustani are consuming the world. Our guest today is Olav Thorheim from my neighboring country with the beautiful fjords, Norway. Olav runs a online magazine called Målmannen. It's a language and cultural political journal edited on one of the two languages in Norway. I bet you didn't know that there was two languages in Norway. We'll talk about some more of that later. But the focus on the magazine is also on culture, politics, music, philosophy, immigration, Islam, Norwegian and European nationalism. It's a magazine that dares to put focus on so many of the controversial questions that all truth-seeking individuals should address with courage and confidence. But our main focus today is on language, as I mentioned, and we're going to get into the work of Professor Frode Jens Strømnes, who wrote The Fall of the Word and the Rise of the Mental Model, a reinterpretation of the recent research on spatial cognition and language. By looking at just language alone, you can come to some pretty interesting conclusions that indeed goes against the false virtues of our times. I think we have some very important information ahead of us. So sit back, enjoy, and I hope you learn something new. Hi, Olav. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Hope you're doing well today.
Yeah, I'm doing well. And you?
Pretty okay. It's busy as usual. lots to talk about. I think we have an important, fight, ahead of us, both as Swedish people and Norwegian people, and to try to get closer to why things are the way they are in our Nordic countries. It feels like an uphill battle sometimes, doesn't it? We have a lot of things to try to bring to the attention of a lot of people, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
It's a challenge, but we got to take it on, right? So why don't we begin talking just a little bit about you here first, Olav? You know, the topic we're going to get into today is very interesting, the symbolic nature of language. We're going to speak more about Frode Jens Strømnes. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about him later, but tell us just a little bit about yourself here in the beginning, about your background, about how you got interested in the topic we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I can do that. So, okay, just to shortly introduce myself, I'm 35 years old. I'm married. I have two daughters, and I live in Norway for the moment. Of my education, I have a PhD in microelectronics, and I lived for several years as a physics researcher in France and Germany before going back to Norway 2 years ago. And in Norway, on my spare time, and I have been editing a magazine called the Målmannen that promotes Norwegian language, culture, and identity. And this last thing has been an interest that I have had since I was a teenager. I've been always been a patriot and a promoter of Norwegian language. As you maybe know, we have two languages in Norway. We have this bokmål and we have this nynorsk, and the names of these two languages are very confusing because bokmål means book language and nynorsk means new Norwegian, but in fact this nynorsk or nynorsk, that is in fact Norwegian language, period. This yes, because this bokmål, that is in fact Danish, because Norway was a colony under Denmark for 400 years, and what happened was that the Danish put Danes to rule Norway, and slowly it emerged an upper class in Norway that were speaking Danish with partly Norwegian accent. And after Norway became independent, then it was a movement that worked for reinstating Norwegian as a official language, and then the upper class had to justify why they were using Danish, so they made some orthographic changes. They changed some vocals, replaced some G's with K's, for example, and in this way they made a modified version of Danish that they called Norwegian, and then this Norwegian language that this Norwegian national movement were trying to reinstate, that was then called Nynorsk, New Norsk. So the Norwegian language that had always been there was then the New Norwegian, and the Danish language was...
Oh, boy.
So people are still talking about that today, Norsk og Nynorsk, Norwegian and New Norwegian, when in fact we are talking about there about modified Danish language and genuine Norwegian language. So this is all kind of confusing. So you can compare the language situation in Norway with the one in Ireland, because there you have something similar. You have a majority using English language, and then you have a minority using the original Irish language. But there you don't have this confusion, because there it's clear. There is a majority that use English. It's a minority that use the national language. In Norway, we have this official propaganda that we don't even have, in fact, officially, there's not two languages. They don't want to say that. They say we have two målform, they call it. I don't know how to translate this word. It's called two different talking ways or something like that.
Right.
So bokmål and nynorsk are two different talking ways of the same language officially. This is just pure nonsense, but... That's how it is today in Norway. So the task of the people who work for a Nynorsk language like me is partly just to start to make people think clearly again about these issues.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about how you got interested in Frode Jens Strømnes, how you learned about him and kind of what got you on that track, basically.
I was always interested in this language issue, and that was partly because myself, I have some parents from the countryside of Norway that speak dialect that is very close to Nynorsk, and then I grew up in the city of Bergen that is very influenced by bokmål, so I had this kind of thing that at home we had Nynorsk, and out on the street and in kindergarten and all this, we had this bokmål. So I was thinking about all these issues at very early age, and very early I can't really remember that I at any moment had to make a decision about this. It was just like always with me, it was like my background is this Nynorsk language, and that's what I stand for, and all this bokmål and all this culture of the city and all this, I'm just opposed to it. So that was kind of, even when growing up in the middle of it, I had it in my heart that I'm basically against all this. I want to stand for something else. So when I became older and became a teenager, then I was very early becoming member of this Nynorsk language movement and starting to be an activist there. And Then I think it was when I was 20 years old, I organized a meeting in Volda in Norway about we were trying to make local people start an organization there to promote this Nynorsk. And then suddenly out of the blue, Frode Jernstrømnes just showed up and he said to start talking, took the word on this meeting and started saying some things that I found very interesting, because he started to say that what you are doing here is not going to lead you anywhere. You need to have an understanding of what language really is. You need to get some better arguments for why we why it has a value to have a Norwegian language. Because normal people just don't see it. Why do we need to preserve our language? Why can't we just use Bokmål or English or whatever? You have no analysis of what language is and what makes it valuable. You need better arguments. And I remember that he said this, and that kind of made me think, because then I also realized that I also didn't really have been thinking through this. Why is this so important to us? And why do we want to preserve our language? And when I was thinking through it, I didn't really have any good arguments. It was just like something that I felt intuitively. It must be right. This is ours. We must protect it. But why? And that's the problem. Everyone who comes to us that say we want to preserve our heritage or culture or whatever, they are just saying you have no argument. This is just irrational. This is just some kind of like romanticism or Stone Age tribe mentality or whatever. Sure. But that's where Frode Jernstrømnes comes into the picture, because he was in fact a scientist. He had in fact done experiments that gave us the evidence that we needed to show scientifically that yes, this to preserve the different languages and cultures are indeed very important.
They definitely are, exactly. It's very important. How, before we kind of get into the details on some of the studies and whatnot that he did, how important would you say that language is to identity and culture? Are they, you know, kind of weaved together as one? So if we lose our language, do we also lose our identity and culture?
Yeah, I mean, like Frode Jernstrømnes showed in his experiments. I mean, like if we look at our the language, it's kind of a system that runs in our brain and that conditions the way we think, the way we sense, the way we like organize and conceptualize everything around us. So this is kind of the framework for how we work as human beings. So if we lose this, then we lose ourselves too. Then there is nothing against of us.
Tell us a bit more then about Frode Jernstrømnes, what the kind of research he worked and you know, when he was alive. Give us the background for people who don't know about him.
Yeah, I can do that. In fact, Frode Jernstrømnes, he was the son of Martin Strømnes, who was the rector, how to say that, the head of
principal, yeah.
The principal of the Lærerskole, teacher high school in Volda. I should say that also Volda is a very little town in West Norway. It's not very big. I think it lives something like 5,000 people there. But it has a special place in Norway still, because it was a place where you have very many schools and you have education for teachers there. So it was historically a very important place, especially for this Nynorsk movement, because you have the education of teachers there, and the teachers were then taught in the Nynorsk, and they were recruited into this Nynorsk movement, and they were spread around all of Norway. And even today it's an important place, because you have a university college there where you have education of not only teachers but also journalists, and the only education for TV is in Volda, so all the TV journalists in Norway are educated there. So it's kind of a center for schooling in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, his father was the principal of this school. Now we are talking about 70 years ago. But I just mentioned this to show that he was already from an academic family, just from the start. And he took his education in psychology, and he went to Finland to work there. And he worked several years in Finland before he came to the University of Tromsø in Norway, where he was a professor for 13 years. And he did a lot of experiments within experimental psychology. I will come back to that. But in any case, in 1990, he was forced to leave his position as a professor in Tromsø. And this was due to some kind of non-conformist views on feminism, because he also had some theories that men and women are thinking differently, and I think this is common sense to most people, but scientifically this is for some reason very controversial.
Right.
So
yeah.
So in fact he lost his position as a professor, and what did he do then? He had already been a professor in 13 years, so he already had the right to be a professor, you know. He was already professor emeritus, and it's difficult to just get rid of someone who has worked as a scientist for so long and have so many publications and all this. So the way to get rid of scientists that start to find out the bothering things, that is to give them something that they called state stipend. This means that you get a yearly salary directly from the state, and then you can do exactly what you want. State doesn't care, but you are forbidden to be at any institution, and you don't get any other kind of help. So it's some kind of way to make you walk around alone in your own world and lose connection with reality and just disappear. So that's the way they are doing it in Norway. So then he was going back to his home place in Volda, and he bought a house there and tried to organize this house into some kind of research institute and continue his work there. But of course this is very difficult when you are just alone and have no more access to like scientific databases or anything. You must find other ways to get access to journals, and so it's very difficult. And he continued his work, and in 2006 he gave out this book about Fall of the World and Rise of the Mental Model. That was 16 years later. But at least he managed to complete his work before he died. So.
Right, yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the research he came up with, some of the areas and fields where he did his work, because it's very interesting. You know, it shows that language is intricately tied to how we view the world around us and how we, you know, build up our kind of mental construct, really, of the world. So he did some really pretty interesting research.
Yes, he did indeed. So to explain what he did, and maybe I should start with explaining a little more general about language. Something I have noticed when I try to convince people about using Nynorsk instead of Bokmål, then people just always respond that no, language, that's just a mean of communication. That's not important. And language is just some kind of vehicle to transport some message. You could have used another language as well. It doesn't really matter. And If we compare to like a computer, for example, this is kind of this would be an appropriate comparison, because, for example, think about internet communication. You have a layered protocol, you have a physical layer, a data link layer, a transport layer, an application layer, and all the different layers, you can just interchange them. The other things that are on top of it don't care. You can run your application on Wi-Fi or fiber or copper or whatever. This doesn't matter.
Sure, yeah.
And it's kind of this same machine view of human being that make people think that, like, language is just a transport mean of passing a message. But that's not how humans work, in fact. And anyway, these are just speculations. We cannot see into the brain of people. If we are really going to know what happens into the brain, what's happening when we are talking, then we have to do research. We have to do experiments. And this is, in fact, what, like, traditional linguists never did. They are just thinking that it must be like this or it must be like that, but they never really done any experimental research like they are doing in natural science. If you compare to natural science, everything are based on, like, experiments and having validated the theories. But in human science, then a lot of what is taught away are simply just pure speculation that have been kind of adopted by other so-called researchers and turned into some kind of theology that is not really based on anything. So we could take a little look into the existing, like, linguistical theology, so to speak, about what do they think about language. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the linguists are thinking about language is that we can take a sentence in any language and just break it down into some kind of other sentences that are called propositions. And these propositions, they are burned into the brain and are the same for all humans. And in fact, the linguists, they are saying that these propositions, these basic sentences, those are kind of sentences kind of like similar to logical statements that could be either true or false. So the argument that they have for this is that propositions can have truth value, while images or maps, they can't have it because they are said to be ambiguous. So the argument that they have is that the sentences must be propositions because propositions can be true and false. While contrary to, like, an image cannot have any information value because the image can be ambiguous. It's not clear what the image says. It cannot be either true or false. That's what they say, but this is based on really nothing. And then they are also saying that, like, images are insufficient for coming with a statement.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they say we can talk about something that we can talk about infinity, but we cannot make a structural model about infinity, but we can still talk about it. This means that there must be propositions that can show infinity. Such kind of, like, play with things is the basis for this idea about the propositions. So we have these linguists that say that there is something called linguistic universalia.
Right.
That means that there are structures that are common for all languages. Like, for example, this analysis of sentence, like subject, verbal, object, for example. These are in all languages, so there must be some universal linguistic structure for language. And then we have this person like Noam Chomsky, who has gone even further and say that there is something like a universal grammar. So once again, this thing kind of makes sense if we have this machine view on a human, like for example a computer or a digital system. These are all built up on small logical true-false statement. And if you, for example, write some kind of source code in some kind of programming language like C or Pascal or BASIC or whatever, then all the code compiles down to the same small assembler instructions that run on the processor. And it's kind of obvious that if it's possible to just take all sentences in all languages and just break them down to some kind of basic sentences that are called proposition and that all must be either true or false. This means just make all sentences into a series of universal binary operation, then it's clear that all languages must be basically the same. But all this is just a theory that they have made, and what Frode Strømnes did, and not just him, also other researchers, that was to start doing experiments to show, is this really true or not? And it becomes very quickly clear that the theory about proposition and universal grammar are directly conflicting with experimental evidence. For example, it was an experiment already done in the 1950s where people were supposed to memorize long lists of new words that they had never heard about. And the results showed that it was very limited how many words people remembered. And normally they could also only remember them in the sequence that they were told them.
Right.
But
yeah.
But if the research persons could look at a certain object while they memorized the word, then something happened, because then it was kind of unlimited how many words they could remember, and they could also remember them in all kind of different sequences, not just the sequence they learned it. So just from this small experiment here, it was kind of clear that there is something that happens when you look at an image and hear a word. There is something happening here, and that's in fact people are building up a model, an image, when they are learning words. And also the theory that they have about this linguistic universalia, like for example that all languages have subject, verbal and object, and therefore they must be kind of equivalent. Then there were also research that's showing that this can't be the whole truth, because like for example Swedish and Finnish, they also have in sentences subject, verbal, and object. But research experiments show that, in fact, they don't carry the same information. They took, for example, sentences in Swedish and presented it to some Swedes, and the same sentences in Finnish and presented it to Finns, and say that you have to cut these texts down, because we need to send them as telegram, and so you just have to shorten everything down. And you were seeing that the Finns were cutting the verb away much more often than the Swedes did. The verb was not so important for the information of the sentence to the Finns than it was to the Swedes. So you could also see from this experiment that even if the same structures are in both languages, they have different weight. They have different importance. It can't be the same information in them.
Do you know when they did that experiment? Do you know if the same information was conveyed though on the receiving end of the telegram? That you know, if a Swede saw that telegram that the Swede sent, they still could. Well, they would have a difficult time understanding it then, right? If the verb was gone, obviously, but. Could the Finns, I guess, convey more information than the Swedes could?
I think this experiment was only that the research person should make the telegrams.
Not on the receiving end, yeah, okay.
I don't think there was anyone in the receiving end. But at least this showed that they were thinking differently about what is important to preserve and what is important to take away, because this was a very clear, significant difference between the two groups.
Right, right.
And then comes the very interesting part, because that shows structurally that what kind of differences we are talking about here. Because Frode Jernströmnes and his colleagues, they did experiments in Finland that shows that the Finnish cases and the Swedish prepositions are corresponding to different mental images that are operated on in different geometries. Just to tell that to the listeners that don't know about this. In fact, Swedish language is very rich on prepositions. And this is contrary to Finnish, that in fact they don't have prepositions at all, but the Finnish are very rich on cases. They have something like 12 cases. So this is one of the major challenges for a Swede to learn Finnish, or the other way, that the Swede can't use his prepositions anymore, and he has to understand how he shall operate all the cases instead. And most people just never find out of this. They just don't understand it. So that's what's also the starting point for Strömnes and his colleagues. Is there another way people can learn languages? And then they were thinking maybe we could try to use mental imagery to analyze the language.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were able, together with research persons who had these languages as their mother tongue, they were able to reconstruct the geometrical models that in Finnish corresponded to the Finnish cases. And then they also managed to reconstruct the geometrical models in Swedish that corresponded to the prepositions in Swedish. And they saw that these structures were very different. In fact, not only were the models different, but the entire geometry, the room where the models were operated on, they were also different, because the Swedish language, they had a vector geometry in three dimensions. It was when you see how these models are operated, the important part is the three-dimensional movement of these models, while in Finnish it's very different, because the Finnish mental room is not in three-dimension, it's only in two-dimension.
So if I can just do a quick example there, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you could, for example, say you could say that someone sits, you know, before the desk, in front of the desk, on the desk, behind it, beneath it, etc. These are prepositions, right, to kind of put you in the three-dimensional space with your objects.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. And with the Finnish cases, you didn't have these three dimensions. You only had two dimension, and it was no more a vector geometry. It was a topological geometry, because what was now important was not the movements around in the room. It was the relationships between the boundaries of the different models that were important.
Interesting.
So the operations done on the Swedish mental model, they focused on the movements in the three-dimensional rooms, and the Finnish operations, they were about to show the relationship between the boundaries and in the two-dimensional room. And if you understand this, then we also have explained this telegram experiment that I told about. Because the Finns were very quickly to take away the verb to shorten the sentence, while the Swedes wanted to keep it. And if we think about this sentence analysis, then the verb is the active part of the sentence. That is the movement. So the movement is very important to the Swedes because it's a movement around in a three-dimensional room, but and the entire meaning goes away if you take that away. Mm. But for the Finns, the important information is in the adverbial part of the sentence that tells us about the context of it, because in the Finnish mental space, then it's the relationship between the boundaries that is important. So if you understand this, then you also can explain this experiment. So from these results, you can prove that a language corresponds to a certain set of models in a certain geometry and with a certain set of operations that you can do on this model. So what this experiment shows is that the traditional linguistics that says that a language is composed of words, and that we think with words and not really with the words either, with these proposition sentences, then we see that this theory must be completely wrong, because the words that we use when we talk, they are in fact nothing else than addresses to find these models and put them together. And except from that, there is no information in the words. The information is in these models. And these models are always constructed so that they have some kind of shape similarity with what they are trying to explain. So it's some kind of like microcosmos of what is happening in the actual world. So
right, it's a mental representation of the real world, and then of course consequently you have different groups of people who uses different languages describing this and replicating this in a different way, right? That's the difference here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about how children are learning languages, then it's kind of obvious that this must be true, because just think about how you learn a child to talk. For example, you take a cup and you say cup, or you jump around on the floor and say jump. You say the word and you do the actual thing that it represents, and this helps the child build up appropriate models of what is actually happening.
Yeah.
And when you speak a language fluently, which means you understand completely the grammar of the language, that is also because you have a totally complete model that you can use. You know exactly which models you have and how to operate on them and how to put them together.
Yeah.
And using these models that Strømnes and his colleagues used, they could help people who had struggled all their life to learn Finnish fluently. Suddenly, they were able to do it with the help of these models. Then suddenly people who had very big problems with learning Finnish, suddenly they spoke it perfectly. The only mistakes they did were this kind of mistake that small children do when they have learned to talk, because then they children use logic, you know, to speak. They don't know of all the small exception to this and that, but except for that, they speak perfectly.
Yeah.
And the same way they also manage to do when they use these models for learning people to speak Finnish language. And they even did an experiment with inventing a totally artificial language and try to teach that language to a research person. And the experiments show that these research persons, they very quickly learned the language fluently when they saw different figures and operations done on these figures together with hearing the sentences.
Yeah, instead of just the theoretical part of just looking at a book or studying in that capacity, right?
Yeah, and they also had a control group of research persons that they tried to learn to this language without showing these figures, and they never managed to learn the language.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is kind of very very clear evidence here that this theory of mental models must be right, because it's proven through experiments that if you want to make people learn a language and you use these models, then people immediately learn the language. That's kind of the key to understanding it, because when we learned a language as children, like I say, then we are building up these models. So we have them unconsciously in our brain. Nature has kind of hidden the model to us, but through experiments, researchers have been able to reconstruct them. So you can take them and you can use them consciously with new person and initiate them into these languages. And I can give you some more examples that are also very interesting.
Yeah, please.
We can see that when people think about certain subjects, then they are thinking in the same way as they are using the language. When they think about a special topic, and will have to make some kind of decision about something, then they also do their conclusion in relation with the geometry of the language that they are using. For example, in Finland, ice hockey is very popular there, just like it is in Sweden. And in Finland, you have Finnish radio stations, but you also have Swedish radio stations, because there is a big Swedish minority in Finland. So what they did was to take the radio commentaries from ice hockey matches, where they had a Swede that talked on the Swedish radio and a Finn that talked on the Finnish radio, and then they tried to compare what the commentators had said. And what Frode Stømnes told me, that when they listened to this, even if it was the same match they were talking about, it sounded like they were talking about two completely different matches, because they were describing what was happening so very differently.
Yeah.
The Swedes, they were constantly following the puck when it was going around, and were showing how the puck was going and how the players were following this one. So they were constantly focused on following the movement in three dimension around on the playing field. But if you listen to the Finnish commentators, they were focused on the relation between the players and how they were positioning themselves in relations to each other. So I think it's already sounds clear to you what I want to say. That once again, you can recognize the Swedish vector geometry and the Finnish topological geometry also when they are commenting here. And there was also another thing that I tried to analyze, and that was when Swedes and Finns had tried to make films out of screenplays. For example, they had taken some screenplays of Henrik Ibsen, like The Wild Duck, which is a classical play that I guess everyone in the world knows who know a little about theater. And there was made a Finnish version of this, and it was made Swedish version. And what they also could show here was that the Finnish films are showing much more often heads and faces of people than the Swedish films do. And they also show movements much shorter and very often incompletely and just in one dimension. So you can see also here that this corresponds to the differences in geometry between the languages. The Swedish is a simple vector geometry in three dimensions, and the movements are important. and to the Finns, it's the topological, the geometry in two dimensions. So to the Finns, it's important to show the relationship between the persons in the screenplay, and when it comes to the movement, they don't even care about showing complete movements. They just show a little part of it and then cut. Now, so, this thing is, in fact, a little interesting also as a Norwegian to think about, because I remember as a child when we only had one TV channel in Norway, NRK. In fact, Norway was the last country in Europe except Albania to only have one TV channel.
Right, yeah.
But, in 1993, we had the second one, but until then, we only had one, and that was also, it was a good part about it also, because that meant that you could come next day at school and talk with your friends about what did you see on TV last night, because right. Everyone had seen the same. Now everyone has their own virtual world, you know.
Right.
That's modern society. But that's not what I wanted to say. This NRK, they had the privilege then that when it was only one TV channel, that they didn't have to care about what people wanted to watch. They could instead think, what should people watch?
Exactly, yeah.
So, and something that the NRK was thinking would be good to have Norwegians watch, that is Finnish theater. So it was sent a lot of Finnish theater in Norwegian TV, and people just hated it. They just, they really just did not understand it. It just seemed meaningless to them.
Yeah.
And if we think about this research that Stromnes did and this analysis of the film, how like the Finnish are not showing movements completely and how they focus on faces and necks of people, and it's another way of like of modeling thing, of structuring thing, and like the Norwegians who have this Indo-European way of thinking, they just don't understand this, and therefore they just reject it. This is just weird. We don't want to see it.
Interesting. Yeah, that's bizarre. So what does this kind of inform us of? There's a lot of interesting components here of what this means, this kind of research and this work. But obviously it points, first of all, to the importance of preservation of language diversity to a certain extent, because you have different languages informing different parts of reality, basically looking at different perspective on things. But it also shows us that, you know, language in itself is more intricately tied to, it's more difficult for people that speak very different languages than, for example, to be, you know, together and understand each other in the same way. Correct.
Yeah, and it's not only that, because Strömnes, he took the a step further, and he said that if it's really true that Finnish people are modeling reality in another way than Swedes do, or in general in another way than Indo-Europeans do, then this means that they must also have bigger problem with using tools and technology that is developed with people with Indo-European background. And he would therefore also expect that there would be more accidents among Finnish speaking when they are using normal Western technology.
Oh, really? Interesting.
This was something that people were just laughing about, but he continued to look into statistics and see what he could find. And he could, in fact, show that it was significantly more accident and also fatal accidents among Finnish workers that worked with technology than it was among Swedes that worked with the same technology. And then he had corrected for all other variables that could impact on this. The only thing that was the difference was the language backgrounds. And there were more accident among the Finns. So, I mean, then you also have what is happening in the world today, where you kind of have this global capitalism that like exports this Western, not just Western culture or Western mindset, but Western technology also,
right,
that is used in China or in Africa or whatever. But in fact, there is a fundamental difference also there. That means that not everyone are adapted to using the same kind of tools or technology. Also there, the language and culture structures are directly impacting how people can use it.
Yeah, exactly. That's very interesting. It means that basically the current modality of globalism is something which is we think that we can implement these things overnight, basically, and that these are simple implementations and what have you. But that's not necessarily true. Then this basically means proven through language, which is a different angle to all these questions, which is interesting. That if we try to, you know, export, you know, one thing to the other part of the world or another thing to that, without, let's say, adaptation to it, without maybe modification to it, it's not going to work as well. It's not going to be applicable. It might even, as you said, in some cases, create accidents, misunderstandings, and all kinds of havoc, basically, right?
Yeah, you are completely right.
Interesting. So what does this mean today, do you think, in terms of if we look at all the multiculturalism, massive influx of immigrants into Europe and the Western countries? What is this doing to us, and how is this, do you think, also contributing to us maybe being prone to change our language, or let's say learn other languages? And if that's the case, wouldn't we be effectively losing who we are if this, you know, if our worldview and everything else is tied to language in this way?
Yeah, exactly. This is we can see here that the language is, in fact, the framework that structures the entire way of how we are. It conditions our brain and our personality. You can see a language as some kind of neural program that runs in your brain. You can let's think the brain is the hardware and the language is the software. And If our brain is the same or not, that scientists can also discuss. But for sure, the brain is being, even from the start, conditioned very differently by the language. And therefore, it also permanently will have a totally different structure. And so to learn a language means to learn a way to think and to conceptualize the world. And just think about it today, when we have something like 10,000 different languages in the world, and 90% of them are threatened of extinction. So when a language dies, it is a way of observing and understanding reality that also disappears and
yeah,
forever.
So yeah.
We are also losing important information about the world and about the entire universe when this happened. This I could also have said initially, but general concept that the language is conditioning our way of thinking, that it is not really a new idea. It's a classical idea that has always been there. It's called linguistic relativity, and also Johann Gottfried von Herder was putting this idea forward. But you know, Herder, he has gone into history as one of these German national romanticists, you know. So these ideas have also been dismissed as just romanticism. But now, in fact, this view can be supported by experimental evidence. So it can no more be rejected like that, and it's another thing that that is very important to understand, and that is, if we see it like the languages as neural programs in our brain, then one can wonder how where do these programs come from, why are they there? And of course, the main reason for such a program to exist is that it makes us a better fit for survival. That's how they have evolved these programs. And Norwegian and Swedish language, they are programs for surviving in the cultural and physical environment of Scandinavia. And just think about it, the richness we have of all these different prepositions, how we can use prepositions to put all kind of sentences together, and this emphasis on movements, that was a very good suited for us, because in the past, how people lived then had to be outside all day in a very hard and brutal environment where you have very quickly had to take a decision and could not wait until tomorrow with doing something like you could do in Africa where it's summer all the year, you know.
Yeah, so exactly.
So these languages were our tools for survival. And now with modern society, everything has changed. We are no more really so dependent on the environmental conditions and the topological factors and like the seasons and weather and all this. So then you can say we shouldn't really care about it anymore. We can just uniformize everything and everyone can use English or Arabic or Chinese or whatever will be the future language, and we just don't care. But the thing is, do we really know if this situation is going to last? Do we really know that this free market globalist system is still running well in 20 or 30 or 40 years? Maybe right. It's going to collapse, and then we will need all these tools that the ancestors used for their survival.
And I think it's more than that, Olav. Even if it functions still or not, it also questions the type of, you know, existence and life that we do live, and the reality that, you know, if we've been prone to live in accordance in a certain way, I think the more we're removed from that, I mean, as you said, we're detached from reality. We're not that, you know, dependent or forced to adapt to the seasons anymore as we were, or, you know, other environmental factors, right? But this also means that when we're detached in this capacity, I think we feel less, let's say, satisfied, for the lack of a better term, less in touch with this nature and in touch with the way of life that has developed us. If we have a genetic predisposition towards acting in a certain way, and then we are not allowed to do that, I think that that's going to create disharmony. It's going to create a very uncomfortable setting for a lot of people. And so I think that the value of life itself and the way that we live our life is potentially very much diminished with the type of globalism and modernity that we see today, you know?
Yeah, and then it comes back to this thing I said in Itchene also about this Nynorsk movement and Frodestrøm Næss, who came to this meeting and say you don't have the tools, you don't have the right arguments to convince people, because now we are coming to the real good arguments why people should use Nynorsk in Norway and not Bokmål, and that is that this is the language that has evolved in Norway, that has been adapted to all the conditions of living in Norway, and for people to live good and appropriate lives in Norway, they should use the mental programs that are adapted to living here. And in fact, then I have to talk about something else also that is interesting, and that is when Frodestrøm Næss went back to Volda to work there at Statsstipendiat. In fact, at the same time, government had given a lot of money to a center that was called the Ivar Aasen Center in Volda, because Ivar Aasen, he was the founder of Nynorsk 150 years ago, and there is a guy called Ottar Grepstad who sits and governs the center and gets a lot of money from the state to do like research on Ivar Aasen and all this stuff, and Frodestrøm Næss went to him and said we should do research on Nynorsk, we should try to identify the mental models of Nynorsk and make an efficient way to learn Nynorsk, And then it was he was bluntly rejected this. This Otto Grepstad, who sat there with his big center with all his money resources, he did not want to help with that. Maybe that goes into another issue, but that's also another side with Norway, that Norwegian government are putting a lot of money into structures that are not working. This movement that is said to promote Nynorsk and this Ivar Aasen Center and all this, they receive so much money from the state for just doing things that leads to nowhere.
Of course.
That it's not promoting a language.
And
then when a person like Sturmnes comes and say, hey, I have a project that could really put this language forward, then they are not interested at all. Either they don't really understand what he's doing, or they are really against it.
Yeah, I think they're against it, to be honest. And maybe we could talk a little bit more about that in the second here, Olaf, as we kind of pick up after the break here, because we do want to get a little closer to... I want to ask you more about the destruction of language and how this has kind of played out today. There's, of course, more on the question of globalism and kind of the preservation of all Indo-European cultures, but you know, Norwegian and Swedish as well in particular, that I want to ask you more about. But why don't we talk just a little bit about your websites before we take a break here. Give us the details where people can read more. I don't know how much you have in English, Olav, if you have any material available in English, but nonetheless, give us the details anywhere where people can go and what some of the work you're doing on the website is.
My website is called Målmannen, and this is it's a Norwegian O, but you can type it with 2 A in English, Målmannen.no. And this is a review that started out 10 years ago more like a pure language review, but it has kind of broadened the topic, and now it's about like culture, language, history, politics, anything. So we have also you can read also about these things that you mentioned here with multicultural and immigration and all these problems that Norway have, because the reason we have started to write about these things also is that I think that you can't just see preserving language as one issue, because it's in fact when you think about what language is, it is a conception of the entire world. So it's kind of, I've started to see more and more like this work for preserving a language, like a work for preserving an entire Weltanschauung, an entire European spirit, so to say, if you know what I try to say. So
definitely.
It's about more than language now. But and another reason is that if you try to write objectively in Norwegian mainstream media about controversial topics like immigration or abortion or gay rights or whatever, you can be 100% sure it's not going to be printed. And I can say this because I have really tried. I have really tried to write a lot of objective articles about issues like this, and I've sent it around to almost all newspaper, and no one publishes it. And it doesn't help that I have a PhD or have been a researcher or whatever. They don't care if it's like non-conform views, they don't publish it. But the strange thing is that if you come with something really idiotic on these issues, then you are being cited. Yeah, if you put on your Facebook page something like all immigrants should be killed or something like that, then media will publish it.
Of course,
So media, when you if you only read the media, then it sounds like there are just two accepted views on these issues. Either you are 100% politically correct, and that's the decent way of seeing it. You are for all this multiculti, mass immigration and all this, and have not any objection at all against it. or you are put together with all these haters and people who want to kill everyone, and like Breivik or whatever, all this.
Right.
All this stuff they are just putting everything into, you know. There is just left no place for any objective, differentiated view that is between these two extremes. It's just not allowed to exist. So if you are trying to promote any kind of alternative agenda on these issues, you need to have your own media platform. That's the only way you can do it.
Yeah. And I think it's because the media is only interested in the extreme viewpoints, because ultimately it's about misrepresentation, right? If they would actually get a sound debate on these issues, where the real the real arguments would be presented, it would show the holes in their facade, right? And it would actually show that they don't have all the answers, and what they're doing right now is complete suicide. So instead, what they do is that they set up this kind of straw man and misrepresentation. That's why they love just associate it with someone who just has a swastika tattooed on their forehead, and you're good to go, right? Because then you don't have to worry about anybody believing anything that anybody says. So it's really wicked, isn't it, that they do it this way?
Yeah, and that's when you hear these discussions about like free speech, and should the right wing extremists have the right to talk freely or not? Then comes this SOS racism, and they say no, they should not have the right to talk freely, because if they are talking out freely in an open debate, in, no matter what you say, the fact that they have been allowed to talk will legitimate them and will make more people hear what they say, and slowly they can gain ground. That's what they say. And in fact, they are 100% right in what they say. The only way they can stop people with nonconformist views is to use these tactics, because if there is an open debate, then it will be very clear very soon who has the good argument and who don't have them.
Exactly. Well, that's why it's funny. It's like in Sweden, listen to this argument, though, but it's for real. I mean, they're seriously contemplating of banning the Swedish Democrats, that party, because they're a fascist party, right? So let's ban the fascist party. It's like, wait a minute, what are you doing now? Are you banning parties? Wait a minute, wasn't that what fascists are supposed to do, right? So, there's no self-contemplation here on anything. There's no, as you said, objective viewpoint in any regard. I think the longer they keep, we're going to take a short break here in a little bit, Ola, but just to wrap this point up here, I think the more they do it in the way that they do it here, the more they kind of deny a real debate about these issues, the more actually people are going to be sick and fed up by the political correctness that they're pushing and everything else. And I think that's actually, in the long run, they're doing us the biggest favor that they can by not focusing on it, right?
I think that's what's already has started to happen. I mean, if you look at the web page statistics of like your country, Sweden, then you see that it's really these politically incorrect websites that are the ones that are most visited.
Yeah, that's right.
The page statistics shows that clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we'll pick up here and talk more about that here in the second. Again, I want to give out the website. So it's målmannen.no, and the way you spell that is M-A-A-L and then M-A-N-N-E-N.no. So it's målmannen.no, and we're going to have this linked up on our website, of course. You can just check it out through there. They also have a Facebook page that we'll link up, so you can check that, and a whole lot of other things there that you can take a look at. So, yeah, very good. Olav, stay with us. We'll take a short break right here, and then we'll be returning with more shortly.